Hello and welcome to the Biotech 2050 podcast. Biotech 2050 is a think tank chronicling the disruptions changing the biotech industry over the next several decades. Check out our website at biotech2050.com. I'm today's host, Alok Tai. I'm the CEO and co-founder of Vibe Bio. Vibe Bio is an investment platform focused on the biotech industry. I'm really excited today to be joined by Craig Chambliss, the CEO and co-founder of Neurelis. Neurelis is a biotech focused on epilepsy and rare CNS diseases. Craig, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
Maybe to kick us off, love it if you could share a little bit about your background and how you got to where you are today.
Absolutely. I was fascinated with the pharmaceutical industry 30 plus years ago, I guess it's been by now, and did everything I could. I had a finance and an accounting background, and it was a challenge without a scientific background to break into this industry. But I was able to, in the early days with Bristol-Myers Squibb, and was fascinated by the opportunity and the impact on patients' lives, but also overwhelmed with the size of the company and knew that I would be better suited in a smaller venue, and had the opportunity to join Alza Pharmaceuticals, which was the premier drug delivery company at the time in the mid-90s when they started a pharmaceutical division. And that was fascinating for me because it was to be a part of a small core group launching that, able to come out to California and experience the home office environment and invite myself to every possible meeting anybody would let me sit in on. I was just a sponge at the time to really gain a better understanding of all aspects of a company in this industry. It ended up serving me very well. I moved from there to Elan to do business development work and some of the analysis of external drug delivery opportunities there, but all along the way, just got a very broad look at enabling technologies, appreciation for what those technologies were able to solve for and the benefits to patients and providers that came as a result of that kind of innovative approach. And in the late 2000, we were analyzing a potential acquisition here in San Diego and ended up in 2001 purchasing a company in San Diego called Dura Pharmaceuticals. And a few of the executives from that transaction decided to split off, and they were looking for some assets to pull out of that combined company and help direct them towards a little product called Diastat and Mycelene, two epilepsy-focused products. Diastat being really the first product that was launched for outpatient management of seizure emergencies with patients with epilepsy it was an incredible little product in terms of being able to administer it, stop seizures quickly, and keep the majority of patients seizure-free for over 24 hours, which is exactly what you want to do in this setting. The only drawback really being in the limiter being it was rectally administered, so it was really confined to the younger pediatric audience. But we took that on. Actually, I joined Excel as well here in San Diego. We launched that product, and it became a bit of a life mission at that time because just seeing the impact that product had on the quality of life, gaining such an appreciation for all the people in the epilepsy community at large, especially these pediatric epileptologists who are meeting families at the most challenging time in their lives and where they're taking a completely different trajectory than what they had expected months before in most cases. And just the time and the effort that was put towards just coming alongside and enhancing as much as possible the quality of life for these patients at this difficult time is in these families was something that just, it caught all of us and just gave us an incredible mission in the epilepsy community and one that has not let hold in all this time. But one of the challenges at the time was kind of put forth by the thought leaders, the key opinion leaders at the time in epilepsy. They, as I say, cornered me in a windowless conference room here in San Diego and said, it's great that you guys are getting the word out about outpatient management of these seizure emergencies and the need for this product, but we really need a product that can address the whole of the epilepsy community who experience these. So it's not just younger pediatrics, it's the older pediatrics, adolescents, and adults. And I asked them, I said, what did this look like? And they said, really, the only thing that makes sense is an intranasal application of the same active, since the active is so effective, so safe. And that sounded easy enough to me in terms of given my background at Alza and Elan, and we set off to really formulate the first intranasal diazepam program for epilepsy. Of course, we were told that it couldn't be done 6 months later by the premier intranasal delivery company at the time in the United States. They said there were two significant issues at play here that has apparently plagued many people beforehand that had attempted to do this. One was the solubility of a very insoluble molecule in diazepam, and they were not able to reach kind of target concentrations in an acceptable spray volume for nasal administration. And then the second issue was the bioavailability. The bioavailability of the predecessor in this space was 90%. And any other attempts at intranasal delivery for really all the benzodiazepines had yielded like 40, 45% bioavailability. So you had a subtherapeutic really exposure to the product as well. So they told us that either one of these issues is a program killer, both of them together makes it impossible. That's when I became like a dog on a bone and said, do I got to figure this out? We had the opportunity, well, actually Valeant, Bausch now, but Valeant at the time came in, purchased Excel Pharmaceuticals in the mid 2000s for the work that we did with Diastat and another program that we had in development. And a few of us went over to a company called Questcor to really take that company down to the foundation, rebuild it as a CNS company around a single product, Acthar Gel, which had just tremendous activity in infantile spasms. It was really the gold standard. And we needed a development program in place. So it was logical that a very complementary program with that would be an intranasal diazepam program. And fast forward a couple of years, and we had at least figured out the solubility aspect of it. And at that point, I decided to talk to a co-founder, my co-founder, David Hale, who was a board member with us at Excel, about starting an epilepsy-focused company here in San Diego and pulling this program out of Questcor, since there was going to be other focus and priorities there, and see about building a company around that. And he agreed, and we went about purchasing the formulations and the IP. We married that with a license to a very unique technology called Intravail, which was the missing piece here for absorption and bioavailability. And it was intriguing to me because here you have this little excipient in a very small concentration in formulations, 0.25% in our application, that has the unique aspect at the cellular level, opening tight junctions for more complete rapid absorption across mucosa. In this instance, it's nasal mucosa, but it could be buccal, transdermal, even gastrointestinal. For me, it was like the light bulb went off. And in 2008, we brought all these pieces together, formed Neurelis with this tremendous idea that this plus this together is the answer that for the unmet need that exists in the epilepsy market. With the challenges of financing at the time, we raised some angel funding in the early days to the tune of a little over $4 million, which was just critical for us to get through the initial formulation and preclinical testing and our really proof of concept PK work. And that work it exceeded our expectations. We pretty much doubled the bioavailability. We did it with a very tolerated formulation, and we use vitamin E as the solvent in this formulation. So it's almost like an oily viscosity that coats the nasal mucosa, allows this intravail to open tight junctions for, you know, really rapid absorption of diazepam across the nasal membrane. Obviously, the site of activity here is the GABA receptor in the brain. So getting across the blood-brain barrier to that site is key for eliminating the, you know, seizure activity and then maintaining these patients in a seizure-free state for 24 hours. We progressed this over the years, and all along the way, it was really impressive because the opportunity was a bit of a magnet, and we brought just the right people came in at the right time who were incredibly passionate about epilepsy, incredibly passionate about recognizing the need that existed to bring a product like this into the market, the need for more emphasis on acute management of seizures and the implications that has on long-term management of epilepsy. And we found ourselves just continuing to amass these consultants that fell in love with the opportunity and started looking at the opportunity to build this out. And it culminated with the approval of Altoco in 2020 and really the desire to take this out to the epilepsy community and build the commercial infrastructure around that. And Neurelis was really formed to address this unmet need. And around that time, we looked at, this is a platform we built in terms of a company that we can get a product through clinical trials, registration, approval, launch, exceptional coverage from a market access standpoint, so patients are not hindered from getting access to the product, and just a passionate team of people to bring this product to the epilepsy community. And so it's the perfect foundational product around which to build a company, because it's really indifferent to the type of epilepsy, indifferent to the chronic therapy, and it's allowed us to layer on other opportunities that address unmet needs and programs and look to enhance what we're doing even with Valtoco in the future as we look to broaden its exposure in the epilepsy market to get it to the patients who need it.
Yeah, wonderful. It's interesting as I reflect on your background. It seems like you've been fortunate enough, or maybe it was destined to be that way, that you had some really interesting kind of corollary experiences between drug delivery, business development, as well as epilepsy, right? And exposure to the CNS space that I think in the aggregate set you up perfectly for Neurelis to be what it is today. So it's really interesting to see that.
Yeah. So epilepsy is such a challenging field. And with all of the almost countless severe encephalopathies, it's encouraging to see, obviously we have a product that has just broad application across so many different types of epilepsy, but it's encouraging to see the research and the targeted research and the precision research and kind of identifying potential pathways that could have an impact on some of these severe epileptic encephalopathies. And it's incredibly attractive to us to consider the future in further enhancing our pipeline and our offerings to the community. We have a library of Rho kinase inhibitors, our ROCK2 inhibitor, that we were especially attracted to. I mean, there's tremendous applications within CNS and outside of CNS with that. But the lead program in that library is our 1049 program for cerebral cavernous malformations. And what really caught our attention is this is usually a ticking time bomb that's not recognized until these patients have a stroke, or in most cases, they have seizures. They present with seizures due to these voluminous brain bleeds. There's millions of patients that walking around with this, but it's a much smaller number that have kind of the clustering of vascular bleeds in the CNS that are, you know, really problematic and no current option for treatment, rather than just really careful symptomatic management through anti-epileptic or anti-seizure therapies, cardiovascular therapies, and just overall just very sedate lifestyle managements. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about this Rho kinase pathway and the ability to, you know, really repair some of this vascular damage, and what we've seen in kind of the targeted preclinical models, the ability to reduce not only the volume of the lesions in the brain on MRI, but the number of lesions as well, is incredibly encouraging. And we're in phase one on that program and looking forward to moving into our 1B, 2A studies here in 2024.
If you're an HR or hiring manager in biotech, you know all too well that the pool of experts seeking full-time employment is shrinking. Filling key full-time positions can be a long, drawn-out ordeal that can slow the pace of execution and growth. Throw away the old hiring playbook. Now you can build a biotech dream team in a fraction of that time. Find out how. Visit clora.com. Clora, talent optimized.
Before we get into the more details around different indications, your vision there, I'd love to take one quick step back and start to map, given your extensive experience in the industry, the peaks and troughs that often occur in these different indications, technologies, et cetera, right?
Yes.
We see in the space of Neurelis, whether it's neuro, CNS, lots of big successes, but also failures. I think CNS, at least at the moment, is now coming back in vogue, which is great. But I also remember not that long ago when, for instance, Pfizer shut down its entire CNS division.
Yes.
Similarly, I think this topic of drug delivery, I think also falls into a similar bucket where, you know, as we discussed earlier, back 20, 30 years ago, folks like Bob Langer, amongst others, were big pioneers in this space. And we're now still waiting to see what happens beyond lipid nanoparticles, as an example.
Yes.
So love to just hear your broader commentary and view of the industry in terms of those peaks and troughs in these different subdomains.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I know after the acquisition of Excel by Valiant in 2005, sitting down with one of our former board members and talking about the opportunity to build a CNS company, and it was really the direction was like, yeah, really CNS is falling out of favor. It's not really investable at the time. And you're absolutely right. There's an ebb and flow to this, but I think one of the things that has just really been encouraging is this really kind of precision medicine approach that exists now that kind of allows us to target specific pathways and genetic challenges that are so prevalent in these CNS diseases. There's a renaissance and a strong appreciation for this. I think it's interesting, in drawing it back specifically to epilepsy, there has been an ebb and flow even within that, in kind of people looking to take a leadership role in epilepsy and really building out an opportunity. And we see that as a tremendous opportunity for the right company with the right phenotype and the right breadth of offerings all the way from early stage development through commercialization to really take a leadership role in the epilepsy area. And that's encouraging because it's gone through the same cycles as we've seen with CNS over the years. And it's exciting to see right now where we're at. I don't see the pullback from that excitement in the near term or even the long term. I think it's an all-in approach now on this. And a lot of that early research and everything is becoming more and more appreciated and really starting to manifest.
Yeah. It is interesting, I think, how at least indications, for instance, tend to become in vogue because of a single catalyst.
Yes.
Right? I'd imagine whether it's Lilly or even prior Biogen's work right in Alzheimer's as of late, maybe is now saying, hey, there's a real market here and there's some successes so we can open the floodgates. It does beget, however, a question around the tension between catalyst versus the science. And those two tend to be fairly orthogonal. What Lilly does with its monoclonal antibodies is going to be different than what platform you have versus something that's coming out of an academic lab, et cetera. How should a early stage founder or executive kind of think about that tension between the broader market and what's happening in adjacent spaces versus the novelty and the potential of their science being in or out of vogue at the time?
I think people get involved with companies and startups for various reasons, but I think where you see real innovation and real result is when there's an absolute passion for driving towards an appreciation for a pathway, a indication, whatever it might be, with dogged determination, not being discouraged along the way. We're dealing with that. There's been like a level of complacency that's existed for such a long time in the epilepsy market on acute management of seizures because there's been no good options. And the one thing that we're passionate about is driving this, and it's really on us because we think we have the ideal product in Valtoco to address the need that exists in acute management of these seizures that break through or that are prolonged or that cluster, because these do damage. They create neuronal pathways, which can lead to the deterioration of the patient, the need to increase and titrate chronic anti-seizure agents and the quality of life deterioration that takes place as a result of that. There needs to be an appreciation earlier on. It's why we're passionate. We see the next level with this is this marriage of AI and wearable technology that's, you know, first and foremost acceptable to the epilepsy patient. It's not intrusive. It's not broadcasting the fact that you have epilepsy because I'm wearing a halo, which measures EEG patterns. It's something that is discrete, but highly predictive of oncoming seizure activity, that when you have a product that is tolerated and able to stop seizures quickly and keep 90% of the time patients seizure-free for a full 24 hours, it's almost an ideal marriage. We've got a glimpse of that in that in our clinical program, we study more seizures than any product in the history of epilepsy drug development. And as expected, about a quarter of the seizures treated, about 900 of those seizures were patients were able to self-administer. They had some type of an aura in advance, which is usually a partial onset seizure that causes some type of a disturbance, could be a visual disturbance, taste, smell, that is indicative of one of these upcoming prolonged cluster seizure episodes, and patients are able to treat and effectively avoid those and maintain a seizure-free state for 24 hours, which is key. So it's like driving towards that. That takes somebody being absolutely committed to upsetting the paradigm that's existed for decades, but believing in it and being surrounded by people who believe in it and on that mission that we want to bring better care to patients. There's something that we know we have something that can impact people in a positive way. And we have to believe it enough to be advocates for that, evangelists for that in the community, because we know it will have a profound impact. And so I think that is key to any kind of transformational program, especially as and viewpoint that in identifying an unmet need and in finding the people who are passionate about it, that are really going to drive it, regardless of what the challenges are with financing pressures, with clinical challenges and the costs associated with that, the challenges in navigating these programs through the FDA and satisfying all the regulatory concerns there. It's like going back to my earlier comments, you've got to be a dog in a boat and just to oversimplify it. But it's
I think being here in San Diego as well is a great example with, I think, the amazing work that Aurora/Vertex did, right, with CF. I think it's another great example of the dogged determination of a small group of scientists that's now led to some really great outcomes, at least for CF patients.
Agreed. It's exciting to see that come out of the San Diego community, because we've seen this community grow up significantly in the last two decades from where it was a lot of early stage work that was swooped up and taken off to the East Coast or Northern California. And now you have just a really strong talent pool in this area that are able to really have a longer term vision and be advocates for these programs far beyond the early stage development.
Makes sense, yeah. Before we get into that topic, one thing I did want to touch upon is the interplay between epilepsy and sort of rare CNS diseases and some of the mechanisms you're starting to see overlap or not overlap when we start to better understand the root causes of monogenic diseases here. And one broader stroke philosophy or observation I've made has been that many of the historically monolithic diseases that we've thought about, whether it's epilepsy, autism, et cetera, where I think it's safe to say that we're starting to see that they actually aren't one big disease, but rather are composed of dozens or hundreds of individual monogenic or otherwise diseases. And this heterogeneity creates both, I think, a challenge and an opportunity. I think the opportunity is to be targeted, but the challenge is that each specific indication tends to be small in comparison. Love to just hear your kind of perspective on that, given that the initial product you've rolled out of Valtoco has the opportunity to touch any disease that has epilepsy as a kind of a phenotype, right? Love to just hear your thought and the tension between kind of those two.
That's one of the, what we see is like really the attractive aspects of Valtoco is given its broad applicability here in epilepsy. But there's a lot of tremendous products available in epilepsy, but there is still, I guess I back this up. When I first got involved in the epilepsy market and started to gain my appreciation was in 2000, where you had nothing for decades that had been introduced to the market with, you know, meaningful impact. And there was this impression that with 30 to 40% of patients being refractory to currently available therapies, the Zonegrins and the Keppras coming on the market and others were going to virtually eliminate the refractory population of epilepsy patients. It didn't move the needle at all. It's just that 30 to 40% still exists today with some really impressive and innovative therapies coming to market, especially as of late, because there was been the mix and match approach and a really a very generalized approach to this. But what we've seen as of late is more targeted approaches to specific, you know, markers in some of these rare epilepsies that, you're right, it provides an opportunity and a challenge. But if there's one thing we've learned in the epilepsy market is we need to break it down to that level to really have an impact. And we have to start looking at things in like smaller populations and start to have very targeted and go back to a more precision approach to addressing the pathways that have allowed for these encephalopathies to exist. And so I think that's a very robust opportunity that exists. And it's exciting to see there's so many early stage, I think we could fill up our pipeline with two dozen different approaches that are, you know, preclinical models that are very attractive from a science perspective, but there's limited resources and some of these are going to be highly effective. Some of these are going to be disappointments, but there needs to be an investment in this because the opportunity and the impact that these can have on patients is significant and valuable in changing lives for the better.
You brought up an interesting topic of preclinical models. I think in the CNS space, there's mixed reviews of preclinical models and their ability to be translated. Curious to hear your broader take on that, because it certainly seems to be a bottleneck in some ways.
It does. And I think being in the epilepsy market, we've had these models available for a long time, but when we get into specific genetic pathways and some of the challenges there, that's more recent, but it's a challenging and risky proposition that requires commitment and investment to really bear this out. We need more tools at our disposal in order to analyze this even beyond mice models. But I think we're definitely on that path, and it's exciting to see kind of just even in the last 5 years, how that's, you know, expanded. You know, the use of AI and identifying these pathways is really quite encouraging. But it's early. It's early. And I think that one of the things that we'll see over the next 5 years is a culmination in some of these efforts that are really starting to yield phase two, going into phase three programs that are validation of these preclinical analyses and helps further refine the approach to make us more targeted and have a higher percentage of shots on goal that are successful a decade from now.
Yeah. Maybe one topic that kind of also dovetails into is how you think about company building and financing. Obviously, in the case of rare diseases with the IRA, there's been a shift away from them. I also think the broader public markets is really just looking for bigger indications, bigger NPV. Would love to just start with your experience sort of fundraising, as well as how you think the broader market is shaping what diseases we go after today at the moment.
I'm entirely disappointed with the impact of IRA on this area, but it's historically been very challenging because there's been the high concentration of interest in rare diseases and targets in rare diseases because of the reward. That's exactly how it should be. There should be, especially when you're talking about some of these ultra orphan indications, there should be strong incentives to pursue those and to bring these opportunities to the market. So anything that disincentivizes that just disincentivizes us as a whole, as a society. That's unfortunate. I don't think it goes away, though, because there's going to be the passion that exists in people that transcends maybe the enormous returns that some companies have seen in the investment in this area, but there'll still be sizable returns, but more importantly, the motivations to solve for these needs that carry people through this. I don't see it ever going away because as long as the opportunity exists and the needs are, there's going to be innovative people that really take their passion and apply it constructively to solving for that need, aside from cold calculations on return on investment.
That's a great point. And I think we often get caught in this short-sightedness, especially in the case of rare, where you do a quick back of the envelope of what the market size looks like without accounting for the fact that those markets tend to grow, especially as new medicines are brought to the forefront. The other part of it, I think, also is that though the expected value in a larger traditional indication might be larger, the likelihood of success tends to also be lower, I feel, as well. So I think some unfortunate circumstances there. As you start to think about then the broader market, obviously Neuros has decided not to go public just yet. How do you think about potentially tapping the public markets and what needs to change in order for that to be viable for a company like yours and others?
It's a great question. I think one of the things that we've always looked at, obviously we're in a very unique situation as a private company with an approved product and
revenues
are growing. It was like 65% plus year over year last year over the previous year, and we're growing at an 80% clip year over year this year versus 2022. To have an orphan drug product, have the commercial infrastructure in place, that engine really in place and just humming, to have early stage developments in place and be in phase one on another innovative product that's addressing an unmet need in rare CNS, to have also this drug delivery business with this InterVail that we have under our control, and we have licensees on that program with one recent approval with OPVI incorporating our InterVail technology. Neffy at ARS has a PDUFA date coming up here in September with that epinephrine program. That's an interesting side business that we have in that. It's not really core to what our CNS focus is, but you bundle that all together, it's a very kind of unique company in that regard. We love the prospects of accessing the public markets, but we've always said that it's got to be where our momentum is matching up market momentum. And we don't want to be in a situation where we're beholden to accessing the public markets, because that's not an attractive situation for anybody to be in. But if we're in a situation like we are right now, where our momentum is strong and we're advancing products through the pipeline, we're constantly looking at other opportunities to bring in-house as well that are going to fit in with the capabilities that we have. Accessing the public markets, when there's momentum there, is just going to enhance our ability to get hold of those products and to further build out our pipeline and our offerings and create an even more robust compounding a growth story for the foreseeable future.
I think the last topic I'd love to spend time on is what you just discussed around the unique, let's call it product or services mix that you have, along with the revenue that you've been able to generate as a private company. I think it's safe to say that's extraordinarily rare. It's also a bit diversified too, right? You have a commercial product, and on top of that, you have a true platform with now multiple licensees actually getting pretty close to approval, right? And likely they will. That's a really unique place to be in, and I feel is the holy grail and the true aspiration for many young founders, yeah, especially, or early stage kind of executives, where you have common platform, you can identify high potential assets that you can develop and get to market, but then also monetize the core platform amongst peers and other adjacent spaces. Given that what you've accomplished is what many seek to do and monetize their science in that way, what advice would you have given the difficulty of running both kind of models in parallel, given that they are fairly different organizationally, business model-wise? I'm sure your investors probably had some strong opinions, positive and negative, about both of those approaches. Love to hear what advice you have for executive teams on this.
It's a little unique for us. So we purchased Aegis, which was who we originally licensed Intervale from, back in 2018. And so that brought these licensees in. We have other undisclosed licensees.
And you've had new licensees come in after the purchase.
Right. Okay. Yes. And so now it's really going to culminate with some of these approvals. We've kept it as a entity within Neurelis. It still exists. George Stewart, who was our CFO, moved in there as our chief operating officer of that Aegis subsidiary just under 2 years ago. We're a bit unique in that it's not, you have platform companies who every pipeline program they have is got to filter through that IP and that platform, and anything outside of that is just not of interest. This is a tool in the toolbox for us. So we're a little unique in that regard. Obviously, mm-hmm, it's the enabling technology. It's the secret sauce for Valtoco.
Yeah.
And what provides the bioavailability that we see with that, and it what just highly differentiates that product from anything currently available, previously available, or even foreseeable in the future. So it's very attractive from that standpoint. It's not something that we see applying necessarily in our rock library and our 1049 program, not necessarily needed in that application. So it's exciting to have a technology like that's available. It's really coming into its own with three approvals, a fourth one on the horizon. And these are not small opportunities either. These are significant opportunities, and there's more to be leveraged in that because it's an enabling technology that can take invasive products that are really only able to be delivered invasively via injection, infusion. And you take that and give it in a non-invasive manner. A great example is our NRL4 program, which is not core to our CNS rare epilepsy business from a commercial standpoint, because it's for acute agitation episodes in schizophrenic and bipolar patients. Mm-hmm. That is another intranasal program with olanzapine, incorporating Intervale with the idea that you get in an outpatient and delivery, self-administered, caregiver-administered, an injectable, an IM profile of olanzapine to abort in agitation episodes that are typically building to a crescendo. And there's nothing that's being able to be used right now, and these patients are typically delivered to the emergency room in the back of a squad car, strapped down and given an injection to stop the cycle. That's a very exciting example of an application of that. That is, we'll take it to really proof of concept. We're getting ready to go into our phase one study here in a couple of weeks, but that's an opportunity for us to look to partner with somebody else to bring that product along, who wants to play in the broader CNS market and bring that along. There's lots of knobs and levers to what we do, and it's fun. But the challenge is really, given that technology, it's due in looking at ways that you can really maximize the impact that technology can have. And that takes really concerted effort.
Yeah.
And when you've got a commercial organization, you've got an early stage pipeline, mm-hmm, you're looking at other epilepsy and rare CNS opportunities, there's competing interests there.
Yeah. It's great to have the optionality, but being able to pursue them in parallel is a would tear any organization apart.
Yeah. So some people overreach with their platforms, mm-hmm, in terms of they become a platform company that's trying to plug anything in there to create relevance because they think there's a market opportunity, and there's not really a differentiated market opportunity that is needed and that a payer is going to buy into and say, look, this is highly differentiated, this is going to provide a benefit to this. So a lot of those are dead ends. It really takes a thoughtful approach holistically, not just, hey, this would be really cool, but what is the market need? What is going to be the viewpoint of third-party payers on this relative to available options? And does this address it, and is it worthy? Because you've got to be able to tell that story to finance that, to bring that product along, partner it if you want to partner it, or to definitely get somebody to pony up for what the cost would be to commercialize that asset.
Yeah. Last question I had for you is, do you think we're in the golden age of biotech right now?
I think we're entering it. It's this decade. I think for all the reasons we've discussed and target precision medicine and targets, and I think like talked about with, especially with some of these rare disorders and the ability to really test at such a micro level for these genetic abnormalities, I think we're coming into the way to pull all this together and be more efficient in drug developments. It doesn't feel like it's very far off.
Yeah. Sounds good.
Yeah.
Awesome. Craig, wanted to say thank you again for the opportunity to join us today and share a little bit about the founding story of Neuralis, some exciting work you're doing in epilepsy, as well as your outlook for the future. Would love to follow up in the not too distant future to see how things progress.
Absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity. And it's thank you for what you're doing, because you're highlighting innovation and giving a platform that is definitely of higher interest to a number of people, especially this next generation that's coming into this market.
We're grateful for the opportunity. And I think it's work of folks like yourselves, along with the support you provide to that next generation, that's going to be most critical. I think being based in Boston, there's a great ecosystem there. And my time here in San Diego, I think, has highlighted the down-to-earth and scientifically focused nature of the community you all have built here that I think is also going to be an important pillar for the future.
Agreed.
Awesome. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Biotech 2050. This episode is hosted by me, Rahul Chaturvedi, and Alok Tai. If you enjoyed this episode of Biotech 2050, please subscribe to our podcast and leave us a review. Also follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Biotech2050Pod. Again, that's Biotech2050Pod. Until next time.